Would you like to explain that? Geryon asked.
Do you remember the warning the Sindar on the road gave to you and Keldar?
About something he called the Raveners, you mean?
Yes. How much did he tell you?
He said that they were ghouls, creatures that feed on the dead. But that's just a ghost story, isn't it?
I am afraid not. I have heard this story from people who have actually seen them. We definitely want to get away from here. Most of the people who live in this forest or near it do not bury their dead. They burn them instead.
I've never cared much for that idea, Durnick spoke up.
It has nothing to do with respect, Goodman, or the lack of it. It is done to protect the living.
All right, Soak said. What are these ghouls supposed to look like? There are a lot of animals around that try to dig up dead bodies.
The Raveners are not animals, Keldar. They are men, or at least that's what they look like. Naturally, they are quite torpid and only come out at night. But during a war, or a pestilence, when there are a large number of bodies unburied, they go into a kind of frenzy. The smell of death attracts them, and makes them wild. They will attack anything when they are like that.
Father, Bulgara said, is this true?
It is possible. I've heard some unpleasant things about these woods myself. I don't usually pursue ghost stories, so I did not bother to investigate it.
Every country has its stories of ogres and monsters, Silk said skeptically. Only children are frightened by them.
I will strike a bargain with you, Keldar,
Tzadi said.
If we make it through these woods without seeing any Raveners, you can laugh at my timidity if you like. But for the sake of the ladies, let's get away from here.
Belgarath was frowning. I don't altogether accept the notion of ghouls, but then I didn't believe there was such a thing as an Eldrak either, until I saw one. We want to move along anyway, and Geryon and I can talk with the orb later.
With Toth once more in the lead, they rode away at a gallop, still following the scarcely visible track that angled off toward the southeast. Their horses' hooves tossed up clots of the leaves lying thick spread on the forest floor as they plunged through the misty wood. The misshapen trees seemed to gape at them as they pounded past, and though Geryon knew it was only his imagination, those grotesque, almost human features seemed somehow to have taken on expressions of malicious glee.
"Wait!" Silk barked suddenly. "Stop!"
They all reined in.
"I thought I heard something. Off that way," Silk said.
They all sat straining their ears, trying to listen over the heavy panting of the horses. Faintly, from somewhere to the east, a scream came out of the fog.
"There it is again," Silk said.
He pulled his horse around.
"What are you doing?"
Belgarath asked him.
"I'm going to have a look."
But Toth had moved his horse around until it was blocking the Drasnian's path. Gravely, the giant shook his head.
"Toth, we have to know what's happening."
Toth shook his head again.
"Toth," Geryon said, "is what Tzadi told us really true? Is there really such a thing as a Ravener?"
Toth's face grew bleak, and he nodded. Another scream came out of the dim woods, seeming much closer this time. The scream was filled with horror and agony.
"Who is it?"
Tenedra demanded, her voice shrill with fright.
"Who is screaming?"
"The men who attacked us,"
Ariand replied, with a sick voice.
"The ones who survived the fight. Something is running them down one by one."
"Raveners?" Geryon asked.
"I think so. Whatever it is, it's horrible."
"They're coming this way. Let's get away from here," Tzadi said.
He drove his heels into his horse's flanks. They plunged off into the gloomy wood, no longer even trying to follow the track.
Their blind flight took them perhaps half a mile farther into the forest when Polgara suddenly pulled her horse to a halt.
"Stop!"
she commanded.
"What is it, Paul?"
Durnick asked her. But she pushed forward carefully to peer at a thicket half obscured in the mist.
"There is someone ahead," she whispered.
"A ravener?"
Geryon asked in a low voice. She concentrated for a moment.
"No. It's one of the attackers. He's trying to hide."
"How far away is he?"
"Not far."
She continued to peer into the shrouding mist.
"There," she said. "He's behind that tree at the edge of the thicket, the one with the broken limb hanging down."
Geryon vaguely saw a dark patch half concealed behind a gnarled tree root rising out of the sodden leaves. Then a movement caught his eye. He glimpsed a shambling figure coming out of the trees. It seemed gray, almost invisible in the hazy fog, and it was so gaunt that it resembled a skeleton. It was dressed in rags, stained with earth and blood. Its pale skull was covered with scanty hair, and it was half-crouched, snuffling audibly as it walked, its arms hanging loosely. Its eyes were vacant, and its mouth agape. Then another emerged from the woods, and yet another. As the creatures advanced, they made a low, moaning sound, expressing nothing remotely intelligible, but rather seeming to convey only a dreadful hunger.
"He's going to run!"
With despairing cry, the hidden assassin leaped to his feet and desperately began running. The raveners took up the chase, their moaning coming faster. Their shambling gait quickened, and their emaciated legs carried them through the woods at a surprising rate of speed. Twisting and dodging, the panic-stricken ruffian fled among the trees, his hideous pursuers gaining on him with every step. When he finally disappeared far back into the fog and gloom, they were no more than a few yards behind him. His shriek was shocking, a horrible sound. Again he screamed, and again.
"Are they killing him?"
Tinedra's voice was shrill. Polgara's face had gone absolutely white, and her eyes were filled with horror.
"No,"
she replied.
"What are they doing?"
Silk demanded.
"They are eating him."
"But," Silk broke off as more shrieks came out of the fog.
"He's still..."
He stared at her, his eyes gone very wide and the blood draining from his cheeks. Tinedra gasped.
"Alive,"
she said in a choked whisper.
"They're eating him while he's still alive."
"That's what I was trying to warn you about, Your Majesty,"
Toddy said grimly.
"When they go into their frenzy, they don't make any distinction between the living and the dead. They will feed on anything."
"Toth," Belgareth said sharply. "Can they be frightened off?"
The mute shook his head, and then turned to Durnick, gesturing rapidly, touching his head and then his stomach.
"I says that they aren't able to think enough to be afraid. All they know is hunger."
"What are we going to do, father?" Polgara demanded.
"We are going to try to outrun them," he replied. "And if any of them get in our way, we will have to kill them."
He looked back at Toth.
"How far can they run?"
Toth raised one hand and traced an arc over his head, then another, then another.
4 days, Durnick interpreted. Belgarath's face became very grim. "Let's go, and stay together."
Their pace through the dreadful wood was more measured now. The men all rode with their weapons in their hands. The first attack came after they had gone no more than a mile. A dozen gray-faced raveners shambled out from among the trees, moaning that hideous hunger, and spreading out to block the path. Geryon spurred forward, swinging his sword in great arcs. Savagely, he chopped a path through the ranks of the slavering raveners, who reached out mindlessly to pull him from his saddle. A terrible, rotting stink rose from them as he rode them down. He killed fully half of them as he crashed through. He whirled his horse to smash into them again, but pulled up sharply, his gorge rising. The raveners who had escaped his sword were tearing at the bodies of those who had gone down, ripping out the dripping gobbets of flesh, feeding them into their gaping mouths, their claw-like hands, even as they continued that awful moan, continued to rip and tear. Cautiously, Belgorath and the others circled around that dreadful feeding, averting their eyes as they passed.
"It won't work, Father," Polgara declared. "Sooner or later, one of us is going to make a mistake. We are going to have to shield."
He thought about it for a moment.
"Well, you might be right, Paul,"
he admitted finally. He looked at Geryon.
"You and Durnik, pay attention to how this is done. I want you to be able to take over when we get tired."
They started out at a walk, as Belgorath and Polgara adjusted the barrier they were creating with a force of their combined will. They had gone no more than just a little way when a gray-faced ravener came loping out from among the twisted trees, slobbering and moaning. When it was perhaps 10 yards from Durnik's horse, it suddenly stumbled back, as if it had just run headlong into something solid. Moaning dreadfully, it came forward again and began to claw at the empty air with its filthy, long-nailed hands.
"Durnik," Polgara said, "would you deal with it, please?"
"All right, Paul."
The smith's face creased into an expression of extreme concentration, and he muttered a single word. The ravener flickered, then popped momentarily out of sight. When it reappeared, it was 20 yards away, beside a large tree. It struggled to lurch forward at them again, but seemed for some reason unable to move.
"Well, that should hold it," Durnik said.
"What did you do?"
Silk asked, peering at the struggling creature.
"I stuck its arm into that tree," Durnik replied. "If it wants to attack again, it's either going to have to bring the tree along or leave that arm behind. Well, I didn't really hurt it, but it's going to take it a day or so to get its arm loose." "Have you got a good hold on our shield, Paul?"
Belgorath asked over his shoulder.
"Yes, Father."
"Well, then let's pick up the pace a trifle. A bit of a momentum won't hurt."
They moved, first at a trot, then at a loping canter. The shield Belgorath was projecting to the front ran ahead of them like a battering ram, hurling the rag-clothed raveners from their path.
"Where do they get those clothes?" Silk asked as he rode.
Toth made a kind of digging motion with one hand.
"He says that they take them off the bodies of the dead that they dig up,"
Durnik translated. Silk shuddered.
"Oh, that would explain the smell."
The next few days began to blur in Geryon's mind. It was necessary to relieve Polgara and Belgorath every 4 hours or so, and the weight of the shield that he and Durnik erected seemed to grow with each passing mile. The fog continued, making it impossible to see more than 100 yards in any direction, and the twisted trees with their semblance of human faces emerged with a shocking suddenness out of that obscuring mist. Shapes, gray and emaciated, moved through the fog, and the mindless moaning came from all around them as they plunged through the ghoul-haunted wood. Night was a time of dreadful terror, as the raveners gathered around the shield, clawing at it and moaning their hideous longing. Exhausted by his efforts of the day, Geryon was forced to use every ounce of his will, not merely to hold the shield in place when his turn came, but also to ward off sleep. Even more than the raveners, sleep was the enemy. He forced himself to walk up and down. He pinched himself. He even went so far as to put a large pebble in his left boot, hoping that the discomfort would keep him awake. Once, all of his devices failed, and his head began to sag slowly forward as sleep finally overcame him. It was that putrid smell that jerked him awake. There, directly in front of him as his head came up, stood a ravener. Its eyes were empty of all thought, its gaping mouth revealed broken and rotting teeth, its black-nailed hands groped out, reaching for him. With a startled cry, he unleashed a heavy blow with his will, hurling the creature backward. Trembling violently, he re-established the barrier that had begun to falter. Then, at last, they reached the southernmost fringe of that dreadful forest and rode out from under the twisted trees onto a fog-shrouded heath.
"Will I keep up that chase?"
Durnik asked his giant friend. The smith's voice dropped from his lips with a great weariness. Toth made a number of obscure gestures.
"What did he say?"
Geryon asked. Durnik's face was bleak.
"Well, he says that for as long as the fog lasts, they probably won't give up. They don't like the sun, but the fog's hiding it, so..."
He shrugged.
We have to keep up the shield then, don't we?
I'm afraid so.
The heath across which they rode was a blasted, ugly place, covered with low thorn bushes and dotted with shallow tarns filled with rusty-looking water. The fog eddied and billowed, and always at the farthest edge of vision lurked those shadowy forms of the Raveners. They rode on. Polgara and Belgarath took the burden of the shield, and Geryon slumped in his saddle, trembling with exhaustion. And then, very faintly, he caught the smell of salt brine.
"The sea!" Durnick exulted. "We've reached the sea!"
"Now, all we need is a boat," Silk reminded him. Toth, however, pointed ahead confidently and made a curious gesture.
"Why, he says that there's a ship waiting for us," Durnick told them.
"There is," Silk seemed astonished. "How did he manage that?"
"I really don't know," Durnick replied. "He didn't say."
"Durnick," Silk said, "exactly how do you know what he is saying? Those gestures of his don't make much sense to me at all."
Durnick frowned. "I really don't know. I hadn't even thought about it. I just seem to know what he wants to say."
"Are you using sorcery?"
"No. Maybe it's because we've worked together so much. Always seems to bring men closer together."
I guess I'll have to take your word for it."
They crested a mound-like hill to look down at a gravel beach where long rollers came in off of the foggy sea and crashed against the rounded pebbles, to slide back again with a mournful hissing as the foam-flecked water slithered down the strand, only to pause, then crash back up again.
"I don't see your ship, Toth," Silk said almost accusingly. "Where is it?"
Toth pointed out into the fog.
"Oh, really?" Silk's voice was skeptical.
The mute nodded. The Raveners, trailing behind, grew more agitated as the company started down toward the beach. Their moans became more urgent, and they began to run back and forth along the crest of the hill, reaching out their clawed hands with a kind of desperate longing. They did not, however, pursue any further.
"Is it my imagination, or does it seem that they are afraid of something?"
Velvet asked.
"They're not coming down that hill," Durnick agreed. He turned to Toth. "Are they afraid?"
Toth nodded.
"I wonder what it is."
The giant made a motion with both hands.
"He says it has something to do with being even more hungry than they are. Something out there. They're afraid of it."
"Sharks, maybe," Silk suggested.
"No, I think it's the sea itself."
When they reached the gravel strand, they dismounted and stood in a weary little group at the water's edge.
"What? Oh, yes, I'm fine, Paul. Just a little puzzled, that's all. If there is a ship out there, I'd sort of like to know who arranged for it, and how they knew that we were going to arrive at this particular spot."
"More important than that," Silk added, "I would like to know how we are going to tell them that we have arrived. This fog is like a blanket."
"Toth says that they already know we're here," Durnick told him. "They'll probably show up in the next half hour or so."
"Oh," Belgareth said curiously.
"And who sent this ship in the first place?" "Well, he said it was Ceradus." "I am going to have a long talk with that young lady one of these days," Belgarath said. "She is starting to make me just a little uneasy about certain things."
"They went back," Ariand told them, as he stood stroking the bowed neck of his stallion.
"Who did?"
Geryon asked.
"The Raveners,"
the boy replied, pointing back up at the hill.
"They gave up and started going back to the woods."
"Oh, and without even saying goodbye," Silk added with a tight grin. "I don't know what's happened to people's manners these days."
The ship that came ghosting out of the fog was curiously built with a high prow and stern, and broad sails on her twin masts.
"What is making it go?"
Zinedra asked, staring curiously at the shadowy shape.
"I don't quite follow you," Geryon said. "They are not rowing," she pointed out, And there isn't even a hint of a breeze.
He looked sharply back at the ship and saw immediately that she was right. There were no oars protruding from the ghostly ship's sides, but in spite of the dead, calm, foggy air, the sails were bellied outward, and the vessel moved smoothly through the oily-looking water.
Is it sorcery?
He pushed his mind out, searching for some hint.
It doesn't seem to be.
At least not any kind that I know about. Belgorath stood not far away, his expression profoundly disapproving.
How are they moving the ship, Grandfather?
Geryon asked him.
It is a form of witchcraft, the old man told him, still scowling. Unpredictable. Usually not very reliable.
He turned to Toth.
You want us to go on board that?
Toth nodded.
Will it take us to Verkat?
Toth nodded again.
You mean that it will, if the sprite that is pushing it does not get bored with the idea, or decide that it might be funny to take us in the opposite direction.
Toth held out both of his hands.
Oh, he says to trust him, Durnick supplied. I wish people would quit saying that to me.
The ship slowed, and her keel ground gently onto the gravel bottom. A broad ramp came sliding out over the side, and its weighted end sank in about 3 feet of water. Toth, leading his reluctant horse, waded out onto the ramp. Then he turned and looked inquiringly back at the rest of them. He motioned with his arm.
"He says we're supposed to board now," Durnick said. "I heard him," Belgorath growled. "All right. I suppose we might as well."
Sourly, he took his horse's reins and waded out into the water. Chapter 23 The crew of this strange ship wore rough, cowled tunics made of heavy cloth. The bones of their faces were prominent, giving their features a peculiarly hewn look. Like Toth, they were all mutes. They went about their work in absolute silence. Geryon, accustomed to the bawling and cursing which accompanied the labors of Kerrick sailors, found this stillness peculiar, even slightly unnerving. The ship itself made none of the usual sounds. There was no rasp of oars in the locks, no creaking of the rigging, no groaning of the timbers, only the faint wash and run of water along the sides, as they were propelled out across that fog-muffled sea by some force or spirit that Geryon could not even comprehend. Once the shore behind had sunk into the fog, there was no reference point, no hint of direction. And yet, the silent ship moved on. Geryon stood with his arm around Senedra's shoulders. The peculiar combination of his near exhaustion from the ordeal in the Wood of the Raveners, and the pervading gloom of dark unbroken water and thick-hanging fog, made his mood melancholy and his thoughts abstracted. It was enough merely to stand at the side of his weary wife, holding her in the protecting curve of his arm, and to look blankly, uncomprehendingly into that fog.
"What in the world is that?"
Velvet exclaimed, from somewhere behind him. He turned and looked toward the stern. From out of the pearly fog there came a ghostly white bird with impossible wings, pinions that appeared longer than a tall man might stretch his arms. The wings did not move, and yet the silent bird came on, gliding through the misty air like a disembodied spirit. Albatross, Polgara identified the magnificent creature.
"Aren't they supposed to be bad luck?" Silk asked. "Are you superstitious, Prince Keldar?"
"Not exactly, but..." He left it hanging. "It is a seabird, nothing more."
"Why does it have such enormous wings?"
"It flies great distances over open water. The wings hold it aloft without any effort. It's very practical." The great-winged bird tilted in the air, giving forth a strange, lonely cry. A sound that carried in it all of the emptiness of that vast rolling sea. Polgara inclined her head in response to that strange greeting.
"What did he say, Paul?"
Durnick asked her in an oddly subdued voice.
"It was quite formal. Seabirds have a great deal of dignity, perhaps because they spend so much time alone. It gives them leisure to formulate their thoughts, I suppose. Land birds babble a great deal, but seabirds try to be profound."
"They're strange creatures,
aren't they? Birds, I mean.
Not once you get used to them.
She looked out at the alabaster bird coasting in the silent air beside the ship, with an indecipherable expression on her face. The albatross moved his great wings and pulled ahead of the ship to station himself just in front of the prow, hanging apparently motionless in the mist. Belgarath had been staring up at the sails, which bellied out improbably in the dead calm air. Finally, he grunted to Toth.
How long does the trip to Verkat take?
Toth measured out a short space with his hands.
That's not very specific, my friend.
Toth pointed upward and spread his fingers wide.
I says about 5 hours, Belgarath,
Durnick translated.
We are moving faster than it appears, then, the old man observed. I wonder how they managed to persuade the sprite to concentrate on one thing for that long. I have never run into one before that could keep hold of an idea for more than a minute. Do you want me to ask him? Durnick offered.
Belgarath squinted back up at the sails.
No, I guess not. I might not like the answer.
The northwest coast of the Isle of Verkat rose dark and indistinct out of the fog as evening approached. They sailed closer with the gleaming albatross hovering just ahead of them, and Geryon saw that the low hills behind the gravel strand were thickly covered with dark evergreens wreathed in fog. Some distance back up from the beach, a few scattered lights gleamed golden in the windows of a village, and a line of torches wound down from that village toward the shore. Faintly, Geryon could hear the sound of singing. The words were indistinct, but the overall tone of the song conveyed a great sadness and an endless longing. Their ship moved silently across a shallow bay, then coasted gently up beside a rude stone quay that looked more like a natural rock formation than any man-made structure. A tall man in a white linen robe stood on the quay. Although his face was unlined and his eyebrows were black as raven's wings, his flowing hair was as silver as Belgarath's.
"Welcome," he greeted them. His voice was deep and peculiarly gentle. "I am Vard. We have long awaited your coming, which the Book of the Heavens revealed to us ages past. Now you see why I don't like these people," Belgarath muttered. "I hate it when someone pretends to know everything." "Forgive us, holy Belgarath," the man on the quay said with a slight smile. "If it will make you more comfortable, we will conceal what we have read in the stars." "You've got sharp ears, Vard," the old man noted. "If you wish to believe so," Vard shrugged. "A place has been made ready for you, and food is prepared. Your journey has been long and difficult. I'm sure you are all very tired. If you will come with me, I will show you the way. My people will bring your mounts and your belongings."
"You are very kind, Vard," Polgara
said, across the rail of the ship as the mute sailors ran their ramp out to the stones of the quay.
Vard bowed. "We are honored by your presence, Lady Polgara. We have stood in awe of you since the beginning of the Third Age."
The path leading up from the bay was narrow, and it wound about with no seeming purpose.
"I fear that you will find our village rude by comparison with the mighty cities of the West," the white-robed man apologized. "We have ever been indifferent to the surroundings." "One place is as much the same as another," Belgarath agreed,
peering ahead toward the cluster of lighted windows glowing in the mist. The village consisted of a score or so buildings constructed of rough fieldstone and thatched with straw. They seemed scattered at random, with nothing resembling an organized street anywhere in sight. The place was tidy, however, with none of the clutter that inevitably seemed to spring up in such places, and the doorstep of each house showed signs of frequent scrubbing. Vard led them to a fair-sized house in the center of the village and opened the door for them.
"This will be yours for as long as you remain. The table is prepared, and some of my people will attend you. Should you require anything else, please send for me."
Then he bowed, turned and walked away into the foggy twilight. The inside of the house was by no means palatial, but it belied the crude-appearing exterior. Each room contained a low, cheery fireplace, exuding warmth and light. The doorways were arched and the walls all whitewashed. The furniture was plain but stoutly made, and the beds were covered with thick, down-filled comforters. A table and benches stood in the central room, and a number of covered earthenware pots stood on the table. The smells coming from the pots reminded Geryon that he had not eaten a hot meal in several days.
"They are a strange sort of people,"
Velvet observed, removing her cloak.
"But you certainly cannot find fault with their hospitality."
Silk had been eyeing the table. "We wouldn't want to offend them by letting supper get cold, would we? I don't know about the rest of you, but I am famished." The supper that had been laid for them was delicious. None of the dishes were anything out of the ordinary, but each was delicately seasoned. The main course was a well-browned haunch of some animal that Geryon did not recognize, but he found it rich and full-flavored.
"What is this delicious roast?"
Tsinedra asked, helping herself to another piece.
"Goat, I think,"
Polgara replied.
"Goat?"
"It seems to be."
"But I hate goat."
"That's your third slice, dear," Polgara pointed out. After they had eaten, they sat around the fireplace. Geryon felt a vast weariness and knew that he should go to bed, but he was simply too comfortable to move.
"Did you get any hints that Zandramas came through here?"
Silk asked.
"What?" No. Nothing."
"She seems to want to avoid inhabited places," Belgarath noted. "I don't think she would have come to the village here. Probably tomorrow. You are going to have to ride out and see if you can cross her trail."
"Wouldn't she have gone straight to Rakvakat?" Silk suggested. "That's where all of the ships are, and she wants to go to Meloria, does she not?"
"She might have made other arrangements," the old man told him. "She does have a price on her head, and the Melorians at Rakvakat are probably as interested in collecting it as the ones at Rakhaga. She's made careful preparations in advance for every step of this journey. I don't think she'd have left anything to chance when she got this far."
Sadi came back into the room, holding the small earthenware bottle.
"Margravaine Lassell, do you suppose I could have my snake back?"
"Oh, I'm so very sorry, Sadi,"
she apologized.
"I completely forgot that I had her."
She dipped into the front of her dress and gently removed the little green reptile. Silk drew back with a sharp intake of his breath.
"I was not really trying to steal her,"
Velvet assured Sadi.
"It was just that the poor dear was very cold."
"Of course," he took the snake from her.
"I was only trying to keep her warm, Sadi. You certainly would not want her to get sick, would you?"
"Your concern touches my heart."
He turned and went back toward the sleeping rooms with Zith lazily coiled about his wrist. The following morning, Geryon went into the shed attached to the back of the house, saddled his horse, and rode back down the gravel strand, where the waves rolled endlessly into the foggy sea to crash against the shore. He stopped, looking first up the beach, then down. He shrugged and turned his horse toward the northeast. The upper edge of the rock-strewn beach was thick with windrows of white-bleached driftwood. As he rode, he idly ran his eyes along those tangled heaps of branches and broken logs. Occasionally, he noted a squared-off timber lying among the other bits and pieces, mute evidence that some ship had come to grief. The possibility occurred to him that the shipwreck that had set those timbers adrift might have taken place as long as a century ago, and that the debris might have floated halfway around the world only to wash up on this strand of salt-crusted pebbles.
"That's all very interesting," the dry voice in his mind said. "But you are going the wrong way."
"Where have you been?" Geryon asked.
"Why do we always have to start these conversations with that same question? The answer would not mean anything to you, so why pursue it? Turn around. Go back. The trail is on the other side of the village, and you do not have time to ride all the way around the island."
"Is Zandramas still here with my son?" Geryon asked quickly, wanting to get the question out into the open before the elusive voice went off again.
"No,"
the voice replied.
She left about a week ago.
We're gaining on her then, Geryon said aloud, a sudden hope springing up in him.
That would be the logical assumption.
Where did she go?
Meloria. But you knew that already, didn't you?
Could you get a little more specific? Meloria is a big place.
Don't do that, Geryon, the voice told him. Ol told you that finding your son was your task. I am not permitted to do it for you any more than he was. Oh, incidentally, keep an eye on Synedra.
Synedra? What for? But the voice had already gone. Geryon swore and rode back the way he had come. A league or so to the south of the village, where a cove sheltered two jutting headlands that ran back into the shoreline, the sword strapped across his back tugged at him. He reined in sharply and drew the blade. It turned in his hand and pointed unerringly due inland. He trotted his horse up the hill with the blade of iron-gripped sword resting on the pommel of his saddle. The trail did not veer. Ahead of him lay a long grassy slope and then the misty edge of the evergreen forest. He considered the situation for a moment, and decided that it might be better to go back and tell the others, rather than to pursue Zandramas alone. As he turned his horse toward the village, he glanced down at the shallow waters of the cove. There, lying on its side beneath the water, lay the sunken wreck of a small ship. His face grew bleak. Once again Zandramas had rewarded those who had aided her by killing them. He kicked his mount into a loping canter and rode back across the foggy meadows, lying between the sea and the dark forest, toward the village. It was nearly noon when he reached the house Vard had provided to them, and he swung down out of his saddle, controlling his excitement as best as he could. "Well?" Belgarath, who sat before the fire with a mug in his hand, asked, as Geryon entered the room.
"The trail's about a league to the south."
Polgara, seated at the table, looked up quickly from the piece of parchment she had been examining.
"Are you sure?"
"The orb is." Geryon unfastened his cloak.
"Oh, I had another visit from our friend." He tapped his forehead. "He told me that Zandramas left the island about a week ago, and that she's going to Meloria. That's about all I could get out of him. Where's Tenedra? I want to tell her that we're getting closer."
"She is asleep," Polgara said, carefully folding the parchment.
"Is that part of one of those books Grandfather's been looking for?"
"No, dear. It is the recipe for that soup we had at supper last night." She turned to Belgarath.
"Well, Father, do we take up the trail again?"
He thought about it, staring absently into the fire dancing on the hearth.
"I'm not sure, Paul," he answered finally. "We were deliberately brought here to this island for something, and I don't think that locating the trail was the only reason. I think we ought to stay here for another day or so."
"We have gained a great deal of time on Zandramas, Father," she reminded him. "Why waste it by just sitting in one place?"
"Call it a hunch, Paul. I have got a very strong feeling that we are supposed to wait here for something. Something fairly important."
"I think it's a mistake, Father."
"That's your privilege, Paul. I have never told you what to think."
"Only what to do," she added tartly.
"That is my privilege. It's a father's duty to guide his children. I'm sure you understand."
The door opened and Silk and Velvet came in out of the sunless noon.
"Did you find the trail?" Silk asked, removing his cloak.
Geryon nodded. "She came ashore a league or so down the beach. She sank the boat that brought her. It's lying on the bottom with the full crew aboard, about 50 yards from shore."
"Oh, she's running true to form, then."
"What have you been up to this morning?" Geryon asked.
"Snooping." "The term is intelligence gathering, Kaldar,"
Velvet said primly, also removing her cloak and smoothing the front of her dress.
"Oh, but it amounts to the same thing, doesn't it?"
"Of course, but snooping has such a nasty ring to it."
"Did you find out anything?"
"Not much," Silk admitted, coming to the fire to warm himself. "All these people are terribly polite, but they are very good at evading direct questions. I can tell you one thing, though. This place is not a real village.
at least not in the sense that we understand it. It's all very carefully set up to look crude and rustic, but the people here go through the motions of tending the crops and herds. It's all for show. Their tools show almost no sign of use, and their animals are just a bit too well groomed.
What are they doing, then?
I think they spend their time in study,
Velvet replied.
I was visiting with one of the women, and there was sort of a chart on the table in her house. I got a look at it before she put it away. It looked like a map of some constellations, a sort of picture of the night sky.
Belgarath grunted. Astrologers. I have never had much faith in astrology. The stars seem to say something different every quarter hour or so.
He thought about it for a moment.
Back at Prolgu, the Gorm said that these people are dolls, the same as the ones who live in southern Meloria. No one has ever been able to figure out what the dolls are up to. They seem to be docile and placid. But I suspect that's only a mask. There are several centers of learning in Dalesia. I would not be surprised to find out that this place is very similar. Did either of you see anyone wearing a blindfold, the way Taradis does?
A seer, Silk said.
I didn't.
He looked at Velvet. She shook her head.
Toth might be able to give us some answers, Father, Volgara said. He seems to be able to communicate with these people in ways that we cannot.
How do you propose to get answers out of a mute, Volgara?
Durnik seems to be able to talk with him, she replied. Where are they, by the way?
They found a pond on the upper edge of the village, Velvet answered. They are checking to see if it is occupied. Arion is with them.
Inevitably, Polgara smiled.
Doesn't it get a little tedious,
Velvet asked.
Having him spend all of his time fishing, I mean.
It is a healthy activity, Polgara said. She looked meaningfully at the mug in Belgarath's hand. And better for him than the amusements of some others I could name?
What next, old friend? Silk asked Belgarath. Let's sit tight for a while. We'll keep our eyes and ears open. I have got a nagging sort of feeling that something important is going to happen here. That afternoon, a faint breeze began to stir the fog that had plagued them for the past week or so. When evening approached, the sky had blown clear except for a heavy cloud bank off toward the west, dyeing the sky a deep scarlet with the setting sun. Sadi had spent the day with Vard. When he returned, his expression was frustrated.
Were you able to get anything out of him?
Nothing I could make any sense out of, the eunuch replied. I think the grip these people have on reality is rather tenuous. The only thing that seems to interest them is some obscure thing they call the task. Vard would not tell me exactly what this task is, but they seem to have been gathering information about it since the beginning of time.
As twilight began to settle over the isle, Durnik, with Arion at his side, returned with his fishing pole across his shoulder and a frustrated look on his face.
"Where's Toth?"
Geryon asked. "I said he had something to attend to," Durnik replied, carefully examining his tackle. "I think maybe I need a smaller hook," he mused.
As Polgara and Velvet began preparing supper, Silk looked over at Geryon.
"Why don't we go stretch our legs?" he suggested.
"You mean right now?"
"I'm a little restless," the weasel-faced man rose from his chair. "Come along," he said. "If you sit in that chair much longer, you're going to put down roots."
Puzzled, Geryon followed his friend outside.
"What was that all about?"
"I want to find out what Toth is up to. I don't want Lizelle tagging along."
"I thought you liked her."
"I do, but I'm getting a little tired of having her looking over my shoulder every place I go." He stopped.
"Where are they going?"
he said, pointing at a line of torches strung out across the meadow, lying between the village and the edge of the forest.
"We could follow them and find out," Geryon suggested.
"Right. Let's go."
Vard led the line of torch-bearing villagers toward the dark forest at the upper end of the meadow, and Toth, towering above the rest, strode beside him. Geryon and Silk bent low to the tall grass, paralleling their course but remaining some distance away. As the torchlit file of villagers approached the edge of the woods, several dim figures emerged from the shadows under the trees and stood waiting.
"Can you make them out at all?"
Geryon whispered. Silk shook his head. "Too far," he murmured.
"And there's not enough light. We are going to have to get closer."
He dropped down onto his stomach and began to worm his way through the grass. The meadow was still wet from the days of dense fog. By the time Geryon and Silk reached the protecting shadows at the edge of the trees, they were both soaking wet.
"I'm not enjoying this much, Silk," Geryon whispered somewhat crossly.
"I don't think you'll melt," Silk whispered back. Then he raised his head and peered out through the trees.
"Are those people blindfolded?"
he asked.
"Sort of looks that way,"
Geryon replied.
"That would mean that they are seers, then, would it not? We didn't see any of them in the village, so maybe they live somewhere in these woods. Let's see if we can get a little closer. All of this is definitely stirring up my curiosity."
The villagers were still carrying their torches and moving into the damp forest. They went in several hundred yards and finally stopped in a large clearing. Around the edge of the clearing stood a series of roughly squared-off blocks of stone, each of them about twice the height of a tall man. The villagers spaced themselves among the stone blocks, forming a torch-lit circle, and the blindfolded seers, perhaps a dozen or so of them, gathered in the center and joined hands to form another circle. Standing immediately behind each of the seers was a large, muscular man, their guides and protectors. In the very center, enclosed within that inner ring of seers, stood the silver-haired Vard and the giant Toth. Geryon and Silk crept in closer. The only sound in the clearing was the guttering of the torches. Then, very quietly at first, but with growing strength, the people in the circle began to sing. In many ways, their song was similar to the discordant hymns of the Ulgos, yet there were subtle differences. Though he was not schooled in musicology or harmony, Geryon perceived that this hymn was older, perhaps more pure than the one which had rung through the caves of Ulgo for 5 millennia. In a sudden flash of insight, he also understood how endless centuries of confusing echoes had gradually corrupted the Ulgo's song. This hymn, moreover, was not raised to Ul, but to a god unknown, and it was a plea to that unnamed god to manifest himself and to come forth to guide and protect the Dals, even as Ul guided and protected the Ulgos. Then he heard or felt another sound, joining with that unbelievably ancient hymn. A peculiar sighing within his mind signaled that these people gathered in their strange circles were bringing their combined wills to bear in a mystic accompaniment to the song, their voices raised toward the starry sky. There was a shimmering in the air, at the very center of the clearing, and the glowing form of Taradas appeared, robed and cowled in white linen, her eyes covered by a strip of cloth.
"Where did she come from?" Silk breathed. "She's not really there," Geryon whispered back. "It's a projection. Listen."
"Welcome, Holy Seeress," Vard greeted the glowing image. "We are grateful that thou hast responded to our summons."
"The gratitude is unnecessary, Vard," the clear voice of the blindfolded girl replied. "I responded out of the duty imposed upon me by my task. Have the seekers arrived, then?"
"They have, Holy Taradas, and the one called Belgerigan hath found that which he sought here."
"The quest of the Child of Light hath only but begun," the image stated. "The Child of Dark hath reached the coast of far-off Meloria, and even now doth journey toward the house of Torak at Asheba. The time hath come for the Eternal Man to open the Book of the Ages."
Vard's face grew troubled. "Is that wise, Saradis?
Can even ancient Belgrath be trusted with what he may find in the volume? His entire life hath been devoted but to one of the two spirits, which control all things.
It must be so, Vard, else the meeting of the Child of Light and the Child of Dark will not come to pass at the appointed time, and our task will remain uncompleted. The time draws nigh, she told them. That for which we have waited since the beginning of the First Age fast approaches, and all must be accomplished ere the moment in which I must perform that task, which hath lain upon us throughout the weary centuries. Give the Book of the Ages to eternal Belgrath, that he may lead the Child of Light to the place which is no more, where all will be decided forever.
Then she turned to the towering mute standing impassively beside the white-robed Vard.
My heart is empty without thee,
she told him, her voice coming very near to tears.
My steps falter, and I am alone. I pray thee, my dear companion, make haste in the completion of thy task, for I am made desolate by your absence.
Quite clearly in the flickering torchlight, Geryon could see the tears in Toth's eyes, and the anguish on his face. The giant reached out toward the glowing image, then let his hand fall helplessly. Saradus also raised her hand, it seemed almost involuntarily. Then she vanished. Chapter 24.
Are you sure she's at Hesheba?
Belgarath asked intently.
I heard her too, Grandfather. Geryon confirmed what Silk had just reported. She said that the Child of Adark had reached Meloria and was journeying to the house of Torak at Asheba.
But there's nothing there, Belgrath objected. Beldon and I ransacked that place right after Vomimbre.
He began to pace up and down, scowling darkly.
What could Zandramos possibly want there? It's just an empty house.
Maybe you can find some answers in the Book of the Ages, Silk suggested.
Belgarath stopped and stared at him.
Oh, I guess we hadn't got to that part yet, the little man said.
Taradus told Vard that he was supposed to give you the book.
Oh, he didn't like it very much, but she insisted.
Belgarath's hands began to tremble, and he controlled himself with an obvious effort.
Is it important? Silk asked curiously. So, that's what this has been all about, the old man burst out. I knew there was a reason for bringing us here.
What is the Book of Ages, Belgrath?
Synedra asked.
It is part of the Malorian Gospels, the holy book of the seers at Kel. It looks as if we were led here specifically for the purpose of putting that book into my hands.
This is all just a little too obscure for me, old friend, Silk said, shivering. Let's go get cleaned up, Geryon. I am soaked all the way through.
How did you two get so wet?
Velvet wanted to know.
We were crawling around in the grass.
That would account for it, I suppose.
Do you really have to do that, Lizelle?
Do what?
Oh, never mind. Come on, Geryon.
What is it about her that irritates you so much? Geryon asked as the two of them went down the hall toward the back of the house.
I'm not really sure, Silk replied. I get the feeling she's laughing at me all the time, and that she's got something on her mind that she is not telling me. For some reason, she makes me very nervous.
After they had dried themselves and changed into clean clothing, they returned to the warm, firelit main room of the house, to find that Toth had returned. He sat impassively on a bench near the door, his huge hands folded on his knees. All traces of the anguish Geryon had seen on his face in the clearing were now gone. His expression was as enigmatic as ever. Belgarath sat beside the fire, holding a large leather-bound book tilted to catch the light, his eyes poring over it intently.
"Is that the book?" Silk asked.
"Yes," Polgarath replied.
Toth brought it.
I hope that it says something to make this trip worth all the trouble.
As Geryon, Silk, and Toth ate,
Belgarath continued to read, turning the crackling pages of the Book of the Ages impatiently.
"Listen to this," he said finally.
He cleared his throat and began to read aloud.
"Know ye, O my people, that all down the endless avenues of time hath division marred all that is. For there is division at the very heart of creation. But the stars and the spirits and the voices within the rocks speak of the day when the division will end, and all will be made one again. For creation itself knows that the day will come, and two spirits contend with each other at the very center of time. These spirits are the two sides of that which hath divided creation. Now the day must come when we must choose between them, and the choice we must make is the choice between absolute good and absolute evil. And that which we choose, good or evil, will prevail until the end of days. But how may we know which is good and which is evil? Behold also this truth. The rocks of the world and of all other worlds murmur continually of the two stones which lie at the center of the division. Once these stones were one, they stood at the very center of all creation. But like all else, they were divided. And in the instant of division, were they rent apart with a force that destroyed whole suns. And where these stones are found together, there surely will be the last confrontation between the two spirits. Now the day will come, when all division will end, and all will be made as one again, except that the division between the two stones is so great, they can never be rejoined. And in the day when the division ends, shall one of the stones cease forever to exist, and in that day also shall one of the spirits forever vanish.
Are they trying to say that the orb is only half of this original stone? Garion asked incredulously.
The other half would be the Sardian, Belgarath agreed. That would explain a great deal.
I didn't know there was any connection between the two.
Neither did I. But it does sort of fit together, doesn't it? Everything about this whole business has come in pairs from the very beginning. Two prophecies, two fates, a child of light and a child of dark. It only stands to reason that there would have to be two stones, doesn't it?
And the Sardian would have the same power as the orb,
Olgara added gravely. Belgarath nodded.
In the hands of the child of dark, it could do just about anything that Geryon can do with the orb, and we have not even tested the limits of that yet.
It gives us just a little more incentive to keep Sandramos from reaching that Sardian, then, doesn't it?
I already have all the incentive in the world,
Tenedra said sadly. Geryon rose early the next morning. When he came out of the room he shared with Tenedra, he found Belgarath seated at the table in the main room, with a Book of Ages lying before him in the light of a guttering candle.
Didn't you go to bed, Grandfather?
What? Oh, no. I wanted to read this all the way through, without any interruptions.
Did you find anything helpful?
A great deal, Geryon. A very great deal. Now I know what Saradis is doing.
Is she really involved in this?
She believes that she is.
He closed the book and leaned back, staring thoughtfully at the far wall.
You see, these people, and the ones at Kel and Delezia, believe that it is their task to choose between the two prophecies, the two forces that have divided the universe. They believe that it is their choice that's going to settle the matter once and for all.
A choice? That's all? You mean that all they have to do is pick one or the other, and that's the end of it?
Roughly, yes. They believe that the choice has to be made during one of the meetings of the Child of Light and the Child of Dark, and both stones, the Orb and the Sardian, have to be present. Down through history, the task of making the choice has always been laid on just one of the seers. At every meeting between the Child of Light and the Child of Dark, that particular seer has been present. I expect that there was one lurking about somewhere at Tol Mishrak when you met Torek. At any rate, the task has finally fallen to Tsaradis. She knows where the Sardian is. She knows when this meeting is going to take place. She will be there. If all of the conditions have been met, she will choose.
Geryon sat down in a chair by the dying fire.
You don't actually believe all that, do you?
I don't know, Geryon. We've spent our entire lives living out the pronouncements of the prophecy, and it has gone to a great deal of trouble to get me here and to put this book into my hands. I may not entirely believe all of this mysticism, but I am certainly not going to ignore it.
Did it say anything at all about Geryon? What is his part in all of this?
I am not sure. It could be as a sacrifice, the way Agachak believes. Or it is possible that Zandramos abducted him just to force you to come after her and bring the orb with you. Nothing is ever going to be settled until the orb and the Sardian are brought together into the same place.
The place which is no more, Geryon added sourly.
Belgaroth grunted. There's something about that phrase that keeps nagging at me. Sometimes I can almost put my finger on it, but it keeps slipping away from me. I have seen it or heard it before, but I can't seem to remember where.
Polgara came into the room. You are both up early, she said.
Geryon is, Belgaroth replied. I am up late.
Did you stay up all night then, father?
It seems that way. I think that this was what I was waiting for. He laid his hand on the book in front of him. As soon as the others get up, let us pack and get ready to leave. It is time for us to move on.
There was a light tap on the outer door. Geryon rose, crossed the room, and opened it. Vard stood outside in the pale gray light of the dawning day.
There's something I need to tell you, he said.
Come in.
Geryon held the door open for him.
Good morning, Vard.
Belgaroth greeted the white-robed man.
I did not get the chance to thank you for this book.
You must thank Zaradus for that. We gave it to you at her instruction. I think you and your friends should leave. There are soldiers coming.
Malorians?
Vard nodded.
There is a column moving out from Rakvarkat. They will probably reach the village before noon.
Can you give us a ship of any kind? Belgaroth asked him. We need to get to Meloria.
That would not be wise just now. There are also Melorian ships patrolling the coast.
Do you think they are searching for us?
Polgara asked.
It is possible, Lady Polgara,
Vard admitted.
But the commander at Rakvarkat has ordered these sweeps through the countryside before, usually to round up any Murgos who still might be hidden on the isle. They stood around for a few days, then returned to their garrison in Rakvarkat. If this present excursion is merely one of those periodic searches, the troops won't be very thorough. They won't come into this vicinity for long. As soon as they are gone, you can come back here, and we will provide you with a ship.
Just how extensive is that forest out there?
Belgaroth asked him.
It's quite large, ancient one. Good. Malorians are not comfortable in forests. Once we get back into the trees, it shouldn't be much of a problem to slip around them. You will need to avoid the hermit who dwells in the forest, however.
The hermit?
A poor, deranged fellow. He's not really an evil person, but he is mischievous. He likes to play tricks on travelers.
We will keep that in mind, Belgaroth said. Geryon, go wake the others. Let's get ready to leave.
By the time everything was ready for their departure, the sun had risen over the low range of hills to the east. Tzadi looked out the door at the bright sunlight streaming over the village, sparkling also on the waves in the harbor.
Where is the fog when you need it?
He asked of no one in particular. Belgaroth looked around.
We have got about 4 hours until the Malorians get here. Let's use that time to put some distance between us and this place.
He turned to Vard.
Thank you, he said simply. For everything.
May all of the gods be with you,
the silvery-haired man replied.
Now go, quickly.
They rode out of the village and up across the meadow to the edge of the dark forest.
Any particular direction, old friend?
Silk asked Belgaroth.
I don't think that it matters all that much, the old man replied. Probably about all we are going to need is a thicket to hide in, Malorians get nervous when they can't see for a mile or so in every direction. They are not very likely to search the woods too extensively.
I'll see what I can find, the little man offered. He turned his horse toward the northeast, but suddenly reined in sharply as two figures stepped out from among the trees. One was robed and cowled, the other was large, a watchful man.
I greet thee, ancient Belgarath,
the hooded figure said in the clear voice of a woman. She lifted her face, and Geryon saw that her eyes were bound with a dark strip of cloth.
I am Onotel, she continued, and I am here to point out a safe path to thee.
We are grateful for your aid, Onotel.
The path lies southward, Belgarath. Some small way into the wood, thou wilt discover an ancient track, much overgrown. It will lead thee to a place of concealment.
And have you seen what is to come, Onotel? Will the soldiers search the wood?
Polgara asked.
Thou and thy companions are the ones they seek, Polgara. And they will search in all parts of the island. But they will not find thee and thy friends, unless it come to pass that someone doth point thee out to them. Beware of the hermit who doth dwell in this wood, however. He will seek to test thee.
She turned then, with one hand outstretched. The large man, standing in the shadows, took that groping hand and gently led her back into the forest.
How convenient,
Velvet murmured.
Perhaps a little too convenient?
She would not lie, Lazelle,
Polgara said.
But she is not obliged to tell the whole truth, is she?
You have got a very suspicious nature, Silk told her.
Let us just say that I am cautious. When a perfect stranger goes out of her way to help me, it always makes me a little nervous.
Let's go ahead and find this path of hers, Belgarath said. If we decide later on to change direction, we can do it someplace private.
They pushed into the shadows beneath the spreading evergreens. The forest floor was damp and thickly covered with fallen needles from the limbs overhead. The sun streamed down in long, slanting shafts of golden light, and the shadows that had the faint bluish tinge of morning. The thick loam muffled the sound of their passage, and they rode in a kind of hushed silence. The track to which the seeress had directed them lay perhaps a mile back into the woods. It was deeply indented in the forest floor, as if at some time in the long distant past it had been much traveled. Now, however, it lay unused, and weeds and grass had reclaimed it. As the sun mounted into the sky, the blue cast to the shadows beneath the trees faded, and a myriad of tiny insects swirled and darted in the shafts of sunlight. Then, quite suddenly, Belgarath reined in his horse.
"Listen," he said sharply.